It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Fighting in Libya aims for control of vital oil terminals. U.S. Ebola coordinator encouraged by progress against the deadly virus. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. In Libya, forces loyal to the internationally recognized government Sunday carried out airstrikes for the first time against pro-Islamist militia based in the country's third largest city, Misrata. It appears to be in response to efforts by pro-Islamist forces to gain control of the Key El Sidra oil terminal. Several oil storage tanks have been set ablaze. Hundreds of thousands of barrels have been lost. Libya's foreign minister, Mohamed El Deri, speaking Sunday in Cairo, said he's concerned about what it would mean for Libya and the region if, in his words, extremist terrorist organizations reach the oil wells and the revenues they represent. The UN mission in Libya says it deplores Sunday's airstrikes on Misrata, saying if the chaos of violence continues, it could lead the country into chaos and all-out war. The U.S. Ebola Response Coordinator Ron Klain told CBS News Sunday the Food and Drug Administration has given emergency fast-track approval to a field blood test that will help contain the deadly virus in West Africa. Klain also said the FDA has approved use of an Ebola vaccine to be released in coming weeks. He was asked about the fight against Ebola.
There's a lot of progress in Liberia. We've gone from 50 to 100 new cases a day down to 5 to 10 new cases a day. But there's still a lot of work to be done in Sierra Leone and some troubling signs in Guinea. So I think we're nearing a pivot point in this where the number of new cases overall in West Africa is somewhat stabilized. But this won't be done till we get all the way to zero. It's like a forest fire. A few embers burning and the thing can reignite at any time.
Meanwhile, a European Union aid shipment arrived in Guinea on Saturday. This is VOA News. On Friday, the World Health Organization said the Ebola death toll had risen to nearly 7,700 with nearly 20,000 known cases. Worldwide, the deadly virus has claimed 7,708 lives, including 6 in Mali, 1 here in the U.S., and 8 in Nigeria. Some 1,000 suspected Boko Haram fighters from Nigeria attacked 5 towns in northern Cameroon over the weekend and briefly occupied a military camp before being driven off by airstrikes. Meanwhile, the Cameroonian military has begun cracking down on Nigerian businessmen in the Bekasi Peninsula suspected of evading taxes. Cameroon gained control last year of the region following a ruling by the International Court of Justice. Smokey Edwin Kinziga reports.
Mayor Aboko Patrick of Kombo Abedimo, a locality in Bekasi, says all people living in his council area must pay taxes as agreed by Cameroon and Nigeria in various treaties that followed the ICJ verdict.
In the Green Tree, one of the articles says that there shall be no indiscriminate collection of taxes within the Bekasi Peninsula. It did not say that there will be no collection of taxes. But the Nigerians, who outnumber Cameroonians, understood that there was no collection of taxes.
Immediately after the ICJ ruling, the collection of taxes in Bekasi was suspended. But beginning August 14, 2013, residents had to start paying their share. Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of Cameroon's southwest region, where Bekasi is located, accused Nigerians of disrespecting the terms of the ICJ ruling by refusing to pay taxes. The International Court of Justice gave Nigeria a 5-year period of transition from 2008 to totally cede the disputed Bekasi Peninsula to Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Bekasi.
The French press agency says a group of more than 150 Rwandan Hutu rebels have turned themselves in the face of threatened action by UN and Congolese forces. As part of efforts to restore calm in the Democratic Republic of Congo's east, the rebels from the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, known as the FDLR, surrendered to authorities in North Kivu province. Other rebels, however, are believed to remain at large with less than a week before the January 2nd deadline. In Morocco, a court specializing in cases of terrorism sentenced 10 people to prison, including some accused of recruiting fighters for Syria and Iraq. Madagascar's former president, Marc Ravalomanana, has been moved to house arrest in the capital, Antananarivo, following months of detention. The ousted leader arrested in October when he returned to the country following more than 5 years of exile following his ouster in a coup in 2009. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, December 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan defends its decision to expel two United Nations officials.
We are a free country. We have our decision. We have our pride. We have our dignity. We cannot leave people to insult us, to us without any sort of, act against them.
Ahmed Bilal, Sudan's information minister, will have analysis of the Somali government's capture of a top al-Shabaab commander. 2014 saw an intensification of Boko Haram insurgency in Nigeria. And the outgoing pro-temp of the Liberian Senate says there were flaws in the December 20th election, but that the system should be improved and respected.
We feel strongly that the Elections Commission needs to look at the process again, perhaps move to electronic voting so that people don't go about trying to buy ballot papers and stuffing the ballot boxes.
Senator Gbezonga Finlay is the outgoing pro-temp of the Liberian Senate. Bamboo bicycles are hitting the streets in Ghana, and Morocco's first solar power plant will start operating in 2015. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's Minister of Information says his government will not compromise on its sovereignty. Ahmed Bilal says Sudan is a free country with pride and dignity and will not allow outsiders to come into the country and disrespect its leaders and people without consequences. Last week, Khartoum expelled two United Nations officials without saying why they were being expelled. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon condemned the expulsions and called on Sudan to reverse its decision immediately. But Information Minister Bilal said the Secretary General should not be quick in condemning his country without first knowing the facts. He said one of the UN officials, whom he did not name, made insulting comments about the Sudanese people and their leaders to a newspaper.
Any diplomatic career, whether it is from a country or from an organization, he has to respect our people and the president and the leaders, and they shouldn't interfere in our affairs. So if anybody goes beyond this and is not following his, mandate of working in Sudan, we have to expel him. And the officials of the United Nations and above them, this Zaatari, have actually announced, or he declared to some Norwegian newspaper, an insulting announcement against our people and against the leadership of our country. And this is not his business, and he shouldn't do that.
The
sovereignty of the country, beyond any sort of doubt, if anyone did that, whatever his situation, we are not going to permit that.
The Secretary General of the United Nations is saying that these people, they were appointed to go and do United Nations duties. So by you expelling them, that is in violation.
No, actually, the Secretary General has to see the reasons. This is not the first time. We can't make expelling people just like that without reasons. And he shouldn't just rush to condemn North Sudan without listening to what are the reasons. He has to be fair and ask why the reason, and then we have to justify that. But just he rushed and said this is not accepted from the Secretary General himself.
One of the spokesmen of the United Nations has said that the expulsion is a retaliation by your government because the United Nations is investigating this alleged rape in Tabib.
No. This is not correct. These people, they have known nothing with that. And the UNAMID is not purely from the United Nations. This is a joint force, the African force with them. And even for that reason, we think this is an allegation. They did this just in a course of making, now there is a campaign, just like the campaign they have done before when they came to this sort of genocide and, the atrocities done in Darfur. They start with such allegations, and they built up these lies till they came to a figure which is not correct, that 300 people were killed, and that's why the indictment happened to the president. Now the same thing they are doing, this saying that there is rape for 200, and sometimes says in another place there is 100, and we are sure they will carry on building this, so lies to make another thing. We are a free country. We have our decision. We have our pride. We have our dignity. We cannot leave people do insults to us without any sort of, act against them.
Ahmed Bilal is Sudan's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. Somalia's government has welcomed the capture of one of the most wanted al-Shabaab commanders. Zakaria Ismail Hersey was captured in a raid on Saturday morning in the town of El Wak near the border with Kenya. Matt Bryden is the former head of the United Nations Monitoring Group on Somalia and Eritrea. He says Mr. Hersey was a senior figure and the chief of intelligence within al-Shabaab.
Well, we know very little about him apart from the fact that the United States government put a $3 million bounty on his head together with other al-Shabaab leaders and identified him as a senior figure, specifically the chief of intelligence in the EMNIA, which is the al-Shabaab's intelligence and counterintelligence wing, and also the part of the organization that engages in assassinations and special operations. And so he was allegedly a very senior figure in the movement and specifically in that part of the movement most responsible for acts of terrorist violence.
And how significant his role was within al-Shabaab?
Well, this is a question of some speculation. When the United States designated him back in 2012, he was, to the best of my knowledge, a senior figure in al-Shabaab and in the EMNIA. And in investigations that I was part of, junior al-Shabaab operatives did identify him in that capacity. My understanding, however, is that he may have been removed or shifted to another position in 2013, and so may not have been holding a position of such high responsibility at the time of his capture. And there is some speculation that he had, in fact, fallen out with the al-Shabaab emir, Ahmed Abdi al-Mahmoud, better known as Godane. And that would be consistent with other developments in the movement last year and this year when the organization did split and there were very serious disagreements at the senior leadership level that led to the purging of anti-Godane leaders in June.
Matt Bryden is the former head of the United Nations Monitoring Group on Somalia and Eritrea. He was speaking with Haroon Maruf of VOA Somali Service. The Nigerian militant group Boko Haram intensified its five-year insurgency and targeted civilians in large numbers, seizing territory in the northeast in 2014. The kidnapping of nearly 300 schoolgirls in Chibok in April sparked global outrage but failed to become the turning point against the militant group. As viewers and look reports, the picture at year's end is one of devastation and uncertainty.
Boko Haram released a video this week of gunmen massacring dozens of men identified only as, quote, prisoners and infidels. The floor of a school dormitory is filled with bodies. Shooters walk over them to finish off those still breathing. The video marks a gruesome end to the sect's bloodiest year to date. Rights groups say militant Islamist sect Boko Haram killed more than 2,000 people in the first half of 2014 alone. That's almost as many as were killed in the previous 4 years of the insurgency combined. In the northeast, Nigerians mourn the dead and the disappeared. The 219 Chibok schoolgirls are still missing. Boko Haram grabbed the girls from their dormitories in April. It woke the world up to terror in northeastern Nigeria. The Twitter hashtag #BringBackOurGirls trended globally. The movement still holds daily rallies in Nigeria. Meanwhile, insurgents seized towns and villages in the northeast. They burned, looted, and slaughtered. They conscripted young men and kept right on kidnapping women and girls for use as wives and servants. At year's end, fighting had displaced more than 1 million Nigerians. In August, Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau declared a caliphate, a designation analysts say is more aspirational than actual. Some analysts say the military seems to be, quote, gaining, but it's hard to measure. The military retakes some towns, even as Boko Haram threatens others. It's a, quote, war of attrition, according to Yola-based professor Kiari Mohammed, who studies the insurgency.
Even if the military were able to push them out of all the urban centers, it is still going to be difficult for them to secure lives and property in the several villages around those. So this is going to be a major problem. It's like they will have to patrol and they will have to physically be present in every inch of the territory. So that, you know, that's going to be fairly difficult.
Boko Haram continued bombing in 2014 as well. There were three major suicide attacks in the month of November alone. Nigeria's military showed signs of strain in 2014. In all, 66 soldiers were sentenced to death for mutiny in the northeast. Soldiers complained they were sent into battle without adequate equipment. Cameroon went on the offensive amid Boko Haram attacks on its side of the border. Nigeria met several times with its neighbors to try to put together a coordinated response.
This is the year where Boko Haram became the real major threat in the region.
That's CEO of the Berlin-based security firm Mossecon, Yan St-Pierre, who monitors Boko Haram. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan is trying to get re-elected in February. The war grinding on in the northeast sets an ominous stage for that vote. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
Today's Monday, December 29th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. The outgoing pro temp of the Liberian Senate says while there were some flaws in the December 20th special senatorial election, Liberians must respect and improve on their electoral process. Senator Bezonga Finlay of Grand Bassa County lost his seat to Jonathan Kaipe of the opposition Liberty Party. Elections Commission Chair Jerome Kokoya announced the final results on Saturday. It appears the ruling Unity Party will have 7 or 8 senators when the legislative body convenes in early January 2015. Outgoing Senate pro temp Finlay said, with no party in the majority, whoever becomes the new pro temp will have to learn to build consensus in order to get legislation passed. Finlay said some of the irregularities that took place in his province and other parts of the country include a ballot buying.
There are a lot of forces and dynamics that played in this election. We feel strongly that the Elections Commission needs to look at the process again, perhaps move to electronic voting so that people don't go about trying to buy ballot papers and stuffing the ballot boxes, and let the people be able to express their true feeling in this process. Put that aside, I think we didn't win. And we must respect the result. Even if we have an opinion that it wasn't fair, whether it was fair or unfair, the results are the results. We must respect that. Democratic process, this is what we have. This is the best we have. We also look forward to improving on the system.
Are you alleging that there was some ballot stuffing that took place?
Well, there were compromise. People were buying ballot papers on election day. People were paying people on election day to go and vote. Those are processes not only in Grand Bassa County that happened. We had in other parts of the country that happened also. But like I said, this is a process that we must give credibility to. Nothing is perfect, and we must improve on that so that we don't have this problem in the future.
What do you think is going to be the makeup of the new Senate now in terms of ruling party senators, opposition senators, independent senators? Can you give us an indication what the new Senate is going to look like in January?
The Senate is going to be a mixture of no party, political party is going to have the majority. So it's going to rely on building relationships and building blocks to be able to get legislation passed in the Senate. As a former manager of the Senate, that was the situation in the past, and it continues. No political party has the majority. And so that makes it difficult to be able to get legislation. But at the same time, you have to be able to build coalitions. You have to be able to work with each other to be able to get legislation passed.
We've come to believe that every time that there is a major legislation that perhaps the president would like to pass, we've been told that perhaps some of the senators just make themselves available for what some people have said they've been bought. Once they give their money, they are willing to cast their votes. You help us to understand.
You see, this is the myth that goes on, that senators are being bored by the executive. That is not true. You've got to understand that the executive did some and take some. The legislature also has to give and take, because not everything the executive wants, they have gotten. Not everything the legislature wants, they have gotten. And when these kinds of negotiations are ongoing, people assume that it's the advantage of the executive. That is not true.
Senator Gbezonga Finlay is the outgoing pro temp of the Liberian Senate. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Bicycle frames are commonly made out of carbon fiber, steel, or aluminum. But in Ghana's countryside, an entrepreneur is trying to show the world another way to make bicycles from bamboo. Christine reports for VOA from Apa in Ghana.
Bamboo does not get much respect in Ghana. Farmers see it as a nuisance to be cleared from their land. Construction workers use it to prop up buildings under construction. But Kwabi Nadanso thinks bamboo is worth more than that. His company, Boomers International, has been making bicycle frames out of bamboo, sending them from the Ashanti region village of Apa to Germany, the Netherlands, Australia, and elsewhere.
It has so many opportunities for the country. Like us, even as we want to go into other products, it's a great opportunity for us to revise and then get the people to know that there's great advantage of bamboo.
Danso takes young men from nearby villages and puts them to work sanding, gluing, and binding his bamboo frames. His company churns out about 50 of the frames per month and uses locally produced bamboo for the frames and cassava flour mixed with epoxy as one of the glues. Besides being a successful social enterprise, Danso says Boomers also serves as a source of livelihood for young men like foreman Abdul Razak. Without this job, Razak says he would still be living at home with his parents.
If this company it is not there, I don't know where I would be by now. Yeah, but because of that, I've got a job somewhere doing, and it's helped me. It helps me a lot.
Danso has sold only a few of his frames within Ghana. One of his customers is Walter Kujoji, who purchased a bike earlier this year. Kujoji says his solid wood frame rarely escapes notice when he goes for rides around his neighborhood.
For example, on Saturday, I rode about 5 kilometers around my neighborhood, and everywhere I went, people were just looking at me, and you could just once in a while you hear the exclamation, "Hey, it's made out of bamboo. Hey, that's the bamboo bicycle," you know? And anytime I stop to take a breather, people come close to me and say, "Wow, we heard about this, but this is the first time we were seeing it. Is it functional? Does it work?" I say, "Yeah, try it."
With his shop overwhelmed with orders, Danso says Boomers is poised for expansion. He hopes to get more of his frames riding around, not just on the streets of foreign countries, but on the roads of Ghana as well. Chris Stein for VOA News, Apa.
Morocco has announced that its first solar energy plant will begin operating in 2015. The plant is part of a multi-billion dollar project aimed at satisfying the growing needs for energy in the North African kingdom. As Latika Hook reports, the Thormos solar plant is the first of five that Morocco plans to build by the end of the decade.
Morocco gets more than a half of its energy from coal. But as its energy requirements grow, the government is encouraging Moroccans to look for cleaner sources of energy.
We need to find alternative forms of energy to meet Morocco's needs, and the best is solar. It's free energy that is unlimited, available, and abundant in Morocco.
Morocco's first solar power plant is being built near the desert gateway city of Ouarzazate.
Ouarzazate is an environmentally sustainable city with energy, recycling, land reclamation, and water-saving resources. It's also about micro-irrigation, wastewater reuse, lighting with solar. It's a smart city.
The $770 million project is expected to have the capacity to generate 160 megawatts. The World Bank, the African Development Bank, and the European Investment Bank are helping to finance the solar complex built by Saudi Arabia. Officials call the project the largest of its kind in the world, and they say it will be operational next year. to raise awareness of the potential of solar energy for Morocco, the oil-scarce country organized its first international solar festival.
We organized this festival to show one idea. Gold is in the sky. The sun is a treasure for our country. We want to demonstrate this through three main areas: arts and culture, science and technology, knowledge and discovery.
Morocco expects to build five new solar plants by 2020 with a combined production capacity of 2,000 megawatts at an estimated cost of $9 billion. Officials are hoping to produce enough clean energy to export some of it to nearby Europe. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Little-known Kenyan Victor Chumo clocked a lifetime best of 28 minutes and 4 seconds to win the Corrida Pedestre International 10-kilometer road race in France on Sunday. Eritrea's former World Junior Championship 5,000-meter silver medalist Abrar Osman was 1 second behind, while Kenya's Frankfurt Marathon champion Mark Kipto pipped Ethiopian Haile Mariam Amare in a photo finish to claim third place. Both were credited with an identical time of 28 minutes and 34 seconds, while Kenya's Ferris Jepchirchir won the women's race in 31 minutes and 34 seconds. Turning to boxing, fighting in front of a partisan home crowd, Ghana's Emmanuel Tagoa knocked out Tanzanian Sadiki Mamba in the sixth round to claim the WBA Intercontinental Lightweight title in Accra, Ghana on Saturday. In an undercard encounter, Ghana's Raymond Comey beat Kenyan Nick Otieno on points to claim the WBA Pan-African Super Bantamweight title. In football, Egypt's Interior Ministry and Ministry of Youth and Sports recently approved a partial lifting of the ban on spectators watching Egyptian Premier League matches, the Egypt Football Federation revealed in Cairo. From the beginning of the second half of the Premier League next year, 10,000 fans will be permitted inside stadiums in Cairo and Alexandria, while 5,000 will be permitted entry at smaller match venues across the country. However, Egypt's top six clubs will continue to play in empty stadiums whenever they play each other, the Egyptian Football Federation clarified. The clubs affected are Orange African Confederations Cup holders El Ahly, their arch rivals Zamalek, Al Ittihad, Ismaili, Al Masri, and Damanhur. Egypt imposed a ban on spectators attending league matches when 74 fans were killed and hundreds injured at the end of the clash between El Ahly and Al Masri in Port Said in February 2012. The league was suspended for a year and only resumed in 2014 amid tight security. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Libyan jets bombed the Islamic militia-held city of Misrata for the first time Sunday as the United Nations warns of all-out war. Libyan forces targeted an area near the city's main airport. It is unclear if there are any casualties. And that is it for this Monday, December 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post-editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Kevin Fowler, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a productive week.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check VOAAfrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.